I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Deep Dish Radio, episode 12. Bruce Sedano and his new album, The Burbank Sessions.
Hey, welcome back to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers. Today's guest, songwriter Bruce Sedano. If he only ever wrote Bad Girls for Donna Summer, that would be enough for some people. But instead, he's written hit records for Reba McEntire, for Michael Jackson, for Dolly Parton. Even Robert Palmer has covered some of his songs. He was a member of Brooklyn Dreams, which recorded Heaven Knows, the monster runaway hit that was everywhere when it was at top of the charts. He wrote Tighter, Tighter for Alive and Kicking, a band that he fronted. And today, Bruce is here to talk about his life and his compositions and how he got to where he is today. Bruce, of course, is the husband of disco queen, undisputed queen of disco, Donna Summer. And that's Donna's voice you hear on Heaven Knows, of course. He wrote Bad Girls for her. And we lost Donna in 2013. Bruce took a look around and said, well, this could be the end of my life as I know it, but instead, I'm an artist. I choose to create, and that's exactly what he did, and he has gone back into the studio to record two albums, the most recent of which is called The Burbank Sessions, and it is, instead of a super-produced disco hit or an AM 70s hit record, it's just Bruce and a guitar and a rhythm section, you know, bass and drums, and it is stripped down. It is singer-songwriter to the extreme. And it is a very, very good album. So I encourage you, after you hear this interview, to check out Bruce's album, The Burbank Sessions, wherever you buy your music. In addition, if you like what you hear on Deep Dish Radio, please tell a friend. Subscribe to the show. We'd love that. And if you really, really like what you hear, head over to iTunes. Leave me a review. I think that would be fantastic. It would help me attract guests. It would help me attract a bigger audience. And, of course, help me attract some advertisers, because I do this for free right now. And you get your money's worth. Let me tell you, there's a lot of great things happening here on Deep Dish Radio. And we want you to be a part of it. And I want to keep doing this. And I want to keep bringing you these interesting interviews. So the best thing you can do is tell everybody you know about Deep Dish Radio. Tweet it out. If you want to tweet me, I'm at Deep Dish Radio. And I have a new email address if you want to get in touch with me. My new email address is tim@deepdishradio.com. It's tim@deepdishradio.com. Or, of course, you can pick up the phone and you can leave a message on my hotline. In the United States, you can call 865-4-TIM-SAYS, 865-4-T-I-M-S-A-Y-S. And that's my voicemail. It actually allows you to leave a message that if you'd like, I can play here on the show. I'd love to hear from you. Love hearing from my audience. You guys are fantastic. Thank you very, very much for listening. It's always a pleasure to bring you these interviews. Here's Bruce. Hope you like what you hear. Deep Dish Radio.
It's Deep Dish Podcast. Subscribe today and tell a friend about Deep Dish Podcast with Tim Powers. With Tim Powers.
You were kind of introduced professionally in the industry by Tommy James, and you co-wrote some music with him, and your experiences with him kind of taught you a little bit about the business and got you in there. Can you talk about how you got involved with Tommy?
Sure. I I was a student at St. John's University, and I had my band Alive and Kicking, which was playing clubs. You know, so basically, I worked my way through college playing clubs with my band, and we were playing at a club in Manhattan called The Cheetah, which was on 52nd Street, right off 8th Avenue. And our manager somehow knew Tommy James's wife.
Okay.
Coincidentally, you know, he lived on 8th Avenue at the time. He lived on 8th Avenue and 54th Street, literally, you know, like right around the corner from where we were playing. So it was really easy for him to come and see us. And so somehow he got talked into coming to see us and saw us and liked the band. And, I was an aspiring songwriter who, basically at that point hadn't really ever been in a recording studio because, you know, in those days, it's not like it is now. It was much more difficult to record. And getting in a studio, you know, studios were hard.
Right, and you had to rent time, and it was expensive. It's not like now where you can spend $100 and have a quality recording.
Right, you know, so it was difficult, and it was always a dream to get in the studio, and you know, and so he came and saw the band, and he liked the band, and basically what ended up happening is that on breaks, when I would have breaks from, you know, we would do six sets a night at the club, and so when I would have, you know, a half hour break, I would go to his apartment and try and write with him, you know, because I wanted to be a songwriter, and I that's what happened. So, you know, after eventually somehow we stumbled onto Ball of Fire, and you know, that happened, and also, you know, even in the making of the record, he was the one. Also at the time, there was this studio called Allegro Studios. And it was in the basement of 1650 Broadway, which was not the Brill Building, but it was kind of like the second music building in Manhattan.
Yeah, it was real close.
There were lots of music related offices and business going on in that building. And in the basement, there was this recording studio that a lot of artists back in the day used. And this is where Tommy recorded. So, he, you know, also on breaks from sets, if he was in the studio, I would go in and sit in and watch him record, you know, Crimson and Clover, you know, Crystal Blue Persuasion, all these songs. And sometimes, you know, he would let me sing a background. But the real thing was, you know, to watch how a record was made and really how a pop song was, you know, was written.
Yeah,
I mean, and so ultimately what happened, he then went on to write a song and produce my band Alive and Kicking. And the following year, we had a hit song called Tighter Tighter, which Tommy wrote and produced for my band.
Right.
The funny thing about that for me is that, you know, there was an Alive and Kicking album that was made as a result of that song being a hit. And, you know, Tommy wrote the one song, and then on the Alive and Kicking album, I wrote the other nine songs. And it's, you know, it's almost an embarrassment to me when I look back on it now, you know.
So you got the B-side of the single, right?
Did I get the B-side of the single? I guess I did. I don't even remember it. Oh, yes, I did. It was a song called Sunday Morning.
Yeah.
Which was actually not a bad song. It was probably, and that particular song never made it to the album. This is how crazy I was in those days. But, yeah. So the B-side wasn't on the album, and it was probably the best song that I had written but, you know, there were songs on that album called, you know, Mississippi Mud and Kentucky Fire and Junction Creek. And, all, you know, here was, I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn.
Flatbush,
and,
yeah.
You know, yeah, in Flatbush. And I had, you know, I knew nothing about Kentucky, Mississippi, or I probably never saw a creek, you know. So, you know, but the thing is that I was, you know, aspiring to write, but I was writing about things that I knew nothing about. And so, but, you know, the thing that's really great about being a songwriter and, you know, what I've come to learn is that, you know, you keep growing and you keep improving and refining your craft. And, you know, there's really, you know, no age limit on inspiration, you know, and as long as you keep living, you can keep writing and having something to say. And this was something that, you know, I didn't know, but as I've gone on, I've learned. And it's, you know, it's been a pleasant surprise for me because I feel that I've continued to grow and continue to learn and continue to get better as a writer. So, and I say that not in coming from a place of pride, but just as to inspire and encourage other people who are writing.
That's, you know. Yeah, and I get it. And, you know, not just writing, but any creative endeavor, just continue to grow and continue to experience, I think, is your lesson. Yeah. Now,
that's,
you know,
while
Alive and Kicking is coming up in its own and you're developing as a songwriter, do you remember what your really early influences were? You know, what was it that made you pick up a guitar? What was it that made you want to write songs? Who did you want to be, Bruce?
Well, I mean, I was inspired by the, you know, Lieber and Stoller and basically, the, you know, those real building songwriters, the Carol Kings, the Neil Diamonds, you know, but they were, you know, just a few years ahead of me. You know, my initial inspiration in music was, you know, as a preteen, when I would go to the shows at the Brooklyn Paramount and the Brooklyn Fox and see all these groups and see all these acts. I mean, that's kind of where, you know, the music bug got in my system. But I actually, you know, didn't see myself as a performer. My inspiration and my aspiration was always to be a writer. So it was those early Brill Building songwriters that I really, you know, aspired to be.
That's really interesting because, you know, I've talked to some songwriters and their inspiration was Elvis or Dylan or, you know, or the time that they saw Hard Day's Night, you know, and and it's an interesting perspective to, you know, bypass the artist's name and look at the writing credits and go, huh, there's a common denominator there. That's really interesting. And become a fan that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's also, you know, as a kid, when I would buy a 45, I was well aware that under the song title, in little parentheses, there was the name of the songwriters.
Right.
And so, you know, I would look at that. That was the first thing I would look at when I would buy a 45 was, well, who wrote this song, you know? And so I don't know why that was my pull, but that was always the attraction for me.
Yeah. Cause it's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Man. And that's not to say that I didn't like to perform, because I love to perform and I love to play live, you know, and I've been doing that since, you know, my early teens. But you know, the artistry side of it for me was always to want to be a songwriter. So
that's really interesting because, you know, you think about that, time and, you know, Cousin Brucey didn't come on and go, hey, it's, you know, Locomotion. And he mentioned Little Eva and nobody else, you know?
Right.
And, so, you know, it's a testament to you, to the music fan within you that you could spot that as you bought your singles.
Yeah. I guess, but
just take it, man. Come on. Alive and Kicking had its hit and you transitioned to Brooklyn Dreams.
Alive and Kicking had its hit and, you know, I always tell the story that when Alive and Kicking had its hit, I became a real jerk, you know, to where I was firing people in the band, and I was a kid who had never, you know, had any hardship. You know, I grew up in a middle class family. I went to great schools. I had a great education.
Right.
I got out of school, and before I graduated, I had a hit song. You know, right after the hit song that I wrote, my band had a hit song. So, you know, here I was, this kid, and I just thought, you know what, this is easy.
So you're barely 22 years old, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was easy, and I took it for granted. And I thought, you know, it was all because of how smart I was. And so quickly thereafter, you know, I, you know, started, you know, writing the songs and controlling everything myself and firing people in the band, and wound up going nowhere, and spiraled into a depression and quit the band. And, you know, basically at that point I moved back into the basement of my parents' house, and spent a year just in the basement writing and you know, soul searching and trying to understand, you know, a little bit about what life was really about, and coming to terms with the fact of how fortunate I was and how difficult it really is to be, you know, to have success and like that. So after that period of time, I moved out to L.A. and subsequently formed Brooklyn Dreams.
Well, you know,
but that was a few years later.
That's an interesting transition, Bruce. I mean, to paraphrase, you're kind of an arrogant kid with two hit records. You think you've got the world by the tail, and you get your comeuppance a little bit socially, retreat to mom and dad's basement, and go through an arc to kind of experience, to lick your wounds and kind of learn what you need to experience. Kind of things happened during that phase, you know, during mom and dad's basement, to bring you to the point where you learned the lessons that you needed?
Well, what kind of things happened? Well, the thing was that I did a lot of listening. I mean, I continued to play, you know, I would put bands together, and I continued to play in clubs, a lot of that time in the bands that I would play with would be Joe Esposito and Eddie Hogenson, who ultimately became my partners in Brooklyn Dreams.
Right.
We were all in Brooklyn playing, you know, in similar bands. Sometimes we would play together. Sometimes we would play in other bands. But I knew them from back then. And I spent a lot of time listening. That's when I taught myself to play the guitar, because initially – I was a keyboard guy because, my first instrument was an accordion. And so I transcended from the accordion into a Farfisa organ, and then ultimately bought the Hammond B3 from the guy in the Shondells. And I was that B3 player in Alive and Kicking. And in mom's basement, that's when I picked up the guitar and learned how to play the guitar and listened to a lot of music. And that's really where it was in those years in the basement where I wrote a lot of the songs that were on the first Brooklyn Dreams album. Funnily enough, but, you know, there was like six of the 10 songs on the first Brooklyn Dreams album were written in the basement, in that phase,
you get your head together. Brooklyn Dreams kind of starts, and I guess it's kind of a cliche for the time, but you got your head together and moved to LA, man. Is that kind of what happened? Or?
Well, you know, the thing is that, I couldn't get arrested in New York. You know, I mean, every song, I mean, you know, I was going to publishers and bringing songs around, and nobody was responding. I wrote this one song and brought it up to this producer, who shall go unnamed, and basically he rewrote my whole song, and it ended up becoming a D.D. Warwick record. And it couldn't even go under my name because I was a BMI writer and he was an ASCAP publisher and a writer. And so I had to make up a fake name to even be on that song. And so the name that I chose was my brother's name is Glenn. Right. So I took G from my brother Glenn's and I made Sedano pseudo. Because in my mind it was a pseudonym. So the actual name, my name on that particular record is G Pseudo. And actually, I've never told that story before. But these were the kinds of things that was going on in that period when I was in the basement and writing, and still, you know, trying to make my way in New York and, you know, working clubs and trying to pitch songs, but not having any luck other than that, you know. That one record that got cut by D.D. Warwick.
Right.
So I got my head together and moved to L.A., I guess.
Well, and you took your punches in New York, you know, and any good artist goes through a period of transition where, you know, you really got to suffer. And at the same time, you learn that it's a business. It's not like... You know, the Beatles analogy works a lot. Everybody thinks that they just came out of nowhere, but they forget those 10-hour sets that they played in the Reeper Bond.
Right, exactly. Yeah. In Hamburg. That's exactly right.
So that's
what I was doing. I was playing clubs, you know, six nights a week and writing songs during the day and surviving.
Making a living, I guess. And so L.A. beckons, and you arrive in L.A. just as people are starting to mutter the word disco? Is that about right?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I got to L.A. in 1976, and I guess disco was happening then. When I met Donna, she just had Love to Love You Baby. So that was kind of like, you know, the beginning of the disco, in a sense.
That's a very safe statement.
but I mean, you know, I was also a guy that, you know, in Manhattan, when we would get through playing and I would go to clubs in Manhattan and go dancing.
Right.
You know, this was in the early 70s and to Barry White Records and Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, and George McRae, you know, Rock Your Baby. I mean, these were predecessor songs to disco, but discotheques were already happening.
Okay.
You know, and it was mostly in the gay world because I'm a straight man, but I in those days I would go to a lot of gay bars and go dancing after playing, you know, live music in, you know, the Electric Circus or whatever, or you know, Trudy Hell is whatever club I happen to be playing in.
Sure.
Whether it be Manhattan or Brooklyn. I was a big Motown fan as well as a big fan of the Rolling Stones. So I had a real affection for R&B music and soul music, as we called it in those days, as well as rock. And the thing for me is that I was always driven to create something unique, you know. When I got to L.A., I was really surprised because that's kind of the culture that I came up in. You know, it was like Tommy James and the Shondells had a very definable sound, as in, you know, a lot of the groups in those days, they were individual in their sound.
Right.
And so I was always driven to create something new, to have a new take on something, or to combine elements to create something new. I wasn't, you know, trying to emulate. But it was interesting because when I got to L.A. and I started going into sessions and seeing how other producers work, I was surprised to find how much, you know, they would have, like, you know, the top 10 records, you know, of the day in the studio and would be spinning them and trying to, you know, write a groove off what was happening.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I was like, wow. You know, and it was almost offensive to me, and it seemed... Yeah, I mean, I understand it much better now, and I can appreciate it now because it's just it's a different way of working.
Right.
But, you know, my idealistic mentality in those days was that, you know, that's not really creating something. That's, you know, you're kind of like borrowing from somebody else, and, you know, it didn't have any validity to me. You know, I later learned that that is a wrong perception, you know, because even, you know, in the contemporary art world, you know, I'm around a lot of contemporary artists these days, and
right.
You know, they will conceive of an idea, but they will have other people, you know, implement it, it was an interesting learning experience to me. So when I got to LA and Brooklyn Dreams were formed, you know, to me, you know, we weren't trying to be a disco band. We were, you know, we were a hybrid of rock, you know, soul and disco. And that was the initial driving force, I think, of Joe, Eddie, and myself. We, you know, we wanted to be a hybrid.
Right.
So, like, on that first Brooklyn Dream, you know, that first Brooklyn Dreams record, you know, we were influenced by the Temptations, and we were influenced by the Stones, and we were influenced a little bit by the dance music of what was happening. And, you know, I always appreciated about disco music was, you know, the musical arrangements, the string arrangements, the horn arrangements. I always thought that, you know, that those things had a great sense of musicality. And, you know, as a songwriter, you know, I remember, you know, longing to be able to get into a studio and have a string arrangement on one of my songs. I mean, you know, this was like a, you know, a dream.
Yeah.
So in making that first Brooklyn Dreams album, you know, our desire was to incorporate all these elements of rock and soul, you know, with string arrangements and also a little bit, but also based around a real good, a well-written song, you know, with a point and a message. And you know, too often in those days, I used to feel like a lot of the R&B songs were, you know, lyrically were, you know, just basic love songs. So I think I was driven to try and take elements of, you know, of the way a Dylan would write a song or a Springsteen would write a song and incorporate it with, you know, the soul with the string arrangements. And so, you know, there's a song in the first Brooklyn Dreams album called Street Dance, which, you know, was for me the predecessor of what ultimately became a song I co-wrote with Joe and Eddie and Donna called Bad Girl.
right,
which became a big hit. But it was Street Dance on the Brooklyn Dreams album that, you know, and that was a song that I wrote back in Brooklyn in my mother's basement in those days, with those years prior.
Right.
So, yeah, anyway, I'm talking a lot about things that I haven't spoken about in a long time.
You know, I couldn't be happier about it, Bruce, really. I mean, there's so much to look forward to, but your career just is so interesting to me. So I'm glad to hear about it.
All right.
With the and I mean the production at that time is just a personal interest of mine. So Brooklyn Dreams puts together a few albums, has its hit. Heaven Knows was a monster. From my recollection and from my research, you know.
And then
Disco explodes, and you are quite literally standing at the forefront, at the side of someone who is inarguably the queen of disco. You know.
Yes. So you know that happened. In 1977, right as Brooklyn Dreams got its record deal, we were living out in Los Angeles. As I said before, we couldn't get arrested in New York. We come to LA, and you know, we're here a matter of months, and we have a couple of record deal offers, and so we end up signing with a new company that was called Millennium.
Right.
And it was a company based out of New York. And initially we were told that, okay, you're going to go to New York to record your album. So we're like, okay. And we give up our apartments and we're ready to go to New York. And literally, you know, like the week before we're leaving, they call us back and they say, no, you know what? There's been a change. You're going to record in Los Angeles. We ended up going out to Irvine, California, which at the time was really rural, if I can say that word properly.
Yeah.
And there was this new studio being built out there, and somehow the record company made this deal with the people at the studio there. The studio was brand new. And so we weren't going to New York, and we had no place to live. So we called our friend Susan Mineo, who was the head of publicity at Casablanca Records. Susan was a girl from our neighborhood in Brooklyn. And we said, hey, look, we don't have a place to live right now because they're moving us to Irvine because we're recording in Irvine. Can we stay at your place for a few nights? And she said, of course, come on. So literally the three of us were sleeping on the floor of her living room in her apartment on Benedict Canyon. And one Sunday, Donna showed up because Donna was on Casablanca Records and Susan was the publicity director. And
right.
And that's basically how we met. And literally Joe, Eddie, myself, and Donna from day one just started writing songs. And you know, we became, the four of us became really good friends. And you know, at the time I had a girlfriend, Donna had a boyfriend, and so there was that situation going on.
Were there sparks right away?
Yeah, it was, right. It was pretty quick. It was pretty quick. And, you know, funnily enough, the day that Donna came to Susan's house, she was, getting a driving lesson because she never had a driver's license.
Wow.
And then subsequently she would end up driving out to Irvine, you know, and a ride, you know, that was, you know, this was no cell phones in those days, you know, and a ride that would, you know, would take maybe an hour, 15 minutes or an hour and 20, you know, she would call when she was leaving. And then literally 3 hours later, we're like, what happened to Donna? You know, But she was learning how to drive and getting lost and finding her way out to Irvine. So anyway, she ended up singing a part on on one song on the first Brooklyn Dreams album.
Old Fashioned Girl, right?
Old Fashioned Girl.
I did my homework.
Which is Yeah, which is another one of those songs that I wrote back in Mama's basement in Brooklyn.
Right.
And yeah, so, yeah, onwards and onwards, and there you go. So.
And then, so the first album comes out on Millennial, and then the next three are all on Casablanca, right?
Yeah, so somehow, you know, I mean, there was Donna at that point was exploding.
Right.
You know, we started our relationship, and there was a lot of pressure from the record companies, my record company and her record company, because my record company was saying to me, Bruce, you're going into this relationship, you're going to destroy your career. You're going to ruin your career because you're always going to be in the shadow of this. And her record company was concerned because they want to control her, and you know, they don't want her distracted by a relationship and all, you know, and whatever. So it was. So ultimately, what happened is Casablanca Records bought out the Brooklyn Dreams contract from Millennium.
Wow.
And it was something we had no control over. And next thing we knew, we're on Casablanca, and they're telling us, you know, they want us to make a disco album. And so it was...
I guess if you're on Casablanca, you know, that's what you do.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so, you know, so we... that's when we made the Sleepless Nights record, produced by Bob Esty.
Right.
But, you know, it was definitely, you know, after the first Brooklyn Dreams album on Millennium, we were talking about, you know, going to the South and being produced by Johnny Sandlin, who was like a guy that produced the Allman Brothers.
Right.
I mean, we wanted to go in more of a rock direction. And once we were on Casablanca, that was completely off the table. So, yeah.
I don't think Casablanca ever recorded an album in Muscle Shoals, did they?
I don't think
probably
so.
Probably not.
No.
That would have been an interesting thing to hear, though, man. That really would have been interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It sure would have, but it never happened.
Yeah. And there you are. So fast forward to 2015, and
2015,
yeah. With all due respect to where you are right now, man. To use a cliche, what a long, strange trip. Here you are, a man and a guitar, you know, and a bare bones band in a studio in Burbank.
Yes,
you know, stripped down and being the songwriter you always wanted to be.
Exactly. You know, it's funny how life will take you. You know, I never anticipated, you know, this phase of my life. I mean, you know, my wife getting sick and passing away was certainly a shock and a surprise and a great adjustment. You know, I mean, you know, I my life was heading in a completely different direction. You know, we were coasting along and getting ready, you know, not to ride off into the sunset but you know, we were in a different part of our life, and all of a sudden I found myself in a situation where I was back by myself again, and the only thing I knew to do was to go back to basics and put a band together and write some songs and start playing. And it's been a very interesting journey, and it's been challenging, but challenges are good. And you know, I've always had the luxury of being surrounded by great singers. You know, Donna, you know, in my opinion, one of the greatest singers ever.
Yeah.
And in Brooklyn Dreams, Joe Esposito and Annie Hokanson are both great singers, you know, so... For me to, at this point in my life, to be the guy to say, okay, now not only are you the writer, you're going to be the singer, was a challenge. But it's been, I've really been thriving on it, and it's been good for me because it's given me places where I still have to grow. I just did this European tour, and it was the first time. I mean, I've been playing shows, the last year and a half, but this European tour was, 3 weeks of night after night of doing the show.
Yeah.
So I've really been able to evolve and refine myself and really, really start to hone in on who I am as a solo artist. And it's been really exciting for me and challenging and it's a discovery. So I'm still discovering myself at this point in my life, which is kind of funny.
Not really, because you're still breathing. I mean, and that's how we started this interview. As long as you're breathing, yeah. There's always something to learn and there's always something to create. And that's why I think the arc of, Bruce Sudano's career is so interesting. They go from, a kid who had a hit before he was 19 years old to, a front row seat at the top of the pop music world in the 70s to where you are right now. Completely exposed as an artist and really finding your heart at a whole new phase in your life that you've never had before. And the stuff that is coming out is so good. It's so good.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll tell you, there's a common theme that I've seen in a lot of the new songs, which are sacrifice and responsibility and especially common sense, which hit me between the eyes when I heard Common Sense today. I was like, what a great anthem for the election.
Yeah. I really feel that song, it's interesting because, songs, I don't know, as even though I've been writing for so long, songs are such gifts. And I'm surprised. I get surprised by a song as well as anybody else. Even regardless of the fact that I write, I may have written a song because once it's out, I don't know how it got there. Common Sense. I'm like going, wow, this is really a song of the moment, and I think it's a message that really needs to be heard right now. And regardless of the fact that I'm singing it and or wrote it, it's just, a song that it's a message that needs to be heard in the world right now.
It's a message that harmonizes with you. It's a message that harmonizes with your worldview. It came from the heart.
Without a doubt. Well, that's where all my songs come from, really.
Awesome.
People always say to me, how did you write these hits, or how did you write? My songs, typically, I always say, the ones that become successful, it's usually by accident, and that I've never been the kind of pop songwriter who, can go in a room and write a nifty, pop, obvious hit. It's not my gifting. My songs are usually stories and come out of some kind of emotional situation in my life or somebody else's life that I observed. So a song like Starting Over Again or a song like Bad Girls or even Common Sense are not typical pop songs. It's not what I'm good at, and I've tried to do it, during the course of my career, and it's I just write bad, commercial songs. I mean, that's the honest. it's just I'm just not good at that. I'm very good friends with a man named Giorgio Moroder, who I'm sure you are who Giorgio is,
right?
But he always says to me, Bruce, why can't you be more commercial? And I'm like, Giorgio, I wish I could. You you are the most commercial, person in the world, maybe. But it's just not, I just don't do it well. But I'm grateful for the gifting that I have. And I think that's something that took me a long time to learn, and that lesson is you know, for any writer or any artist, you know, is you have to be who you are, you know, and, you know, you can't compare yourself or judge yourself. You know, it's always an individual challenge to be the best you that you can be and to, you know, play up your own strengths and work on your own weaknesses. And that's, you know, the a lesson that, you know, it took me a while to learn.
And that's the lesson that got you to Burbank Sessions, huh?
It is, without a doubt. Wow. It's the lesson that, you know, when you know, when I go on stage and I'm nervous to sing or I feel insecure, I just say, you know, stay in the song, let the song speak, and then you'll be fine, and that's the truth, you know. So you know, in spite of, you know, the tragedy in my life, you know, I am a very grateful person, and I'm very grateful for the life that I have had, and it's the grace of God, and because we all try hard, and I've been a blessed man.
Yeah, and you know, like we say, your heart's still beating, so there's still life to live. You know,
you're, oh yeah, baby,
and they're still creating to do. Yeah. So that being said, what's the plan for 2016? Is there a tour? Is there another album? Is there a Broadway musical based on the music of Bruce Sudano?
There 2016 is right now. I just got back from Europe. I just did basically six weeks in Europe. So I'm here. I'm home for the holidays. I'm here for into the new year, and then over this first part of the year, I'm going to be doing some songwriting. And March, I'll be heading out to play shows. I'm going to start by appearing at some things at South by Southwest, and then I'm going to do an East Coast run of shows, and then probably come around back to the West Coast and do a run of shows. And keep writing along the way. And once I compile enough songs to make another record, I'll do that. I don't know when that happens.
It'll happen when it's time, right?
It'll happen when it's time, right? Exactly.
Cool.
So that's where it's at.
Well, then, if you, listener, are ready to see Bruce, this is the place to go to find out. What's your how's your social media set up, Bruce? Where can people find out more about you and your tours and pick up these albums?
BruceSudano.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the obvious places.
All the usual suspects.
All the usual suspects. And when I'm in L.A., my favorite place to play is Genghis Cohen.
Yeah!
Been there forever, and so on Fairfax, and I'll probably at some point in February I'll do a couple nights in Genghis, so I'll be posting that. So if anybody's in LA and wants to come out, I'd appreciate seeing everybody.
Man, you'll see me there. The sound in that room is so good.
Yeah, it's a great little room, and I have a very fond affection for it. So
very cool. Are your girls in LA for the holidays? Your daughters?
Yeah. Two of them are. Brooklyn and Amanda are. Well, Amanda is on the road right now. She's my daughter Amanda is in a duo with her husband. They're called Johnny Swim. Maybe some of you know Johnny Swim. If not, check them out. They actually just finished doing three nights at the Troubadour.
Very cool.
Here in L.A. And they're doing a Christmas tour. This is their second annual Christmas tour where they doing a tour of the states where they do some of their own songs and do a lot of Christmas songs. And they wind up at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville on December 21st, and then they're back to L.A. And so we'll be together for Christmas. And like that. So
how exciting.
Yeah, and my daughter Brooklyn is an actress. She is currently on a show called Ballers, which is on HBO. She's doing well. And my daughter Mimi is the mother of four.
Wow.
And so the family is thriving and carrying on and respecting the legacy of Donna and doing the best we can. So
beautiful.
There you go.
That's a great place to stop. Bruce, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah.
And
same here, Tim. Thank you.
As the next album comes out, I hope you'll look to us and come back and hang out.
Without a doubt. We'll definitely do it. I appreciate it very much. And good talking to you.